You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 244 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of beautiful downtown thoroughfare. Really upcoming neighborhood in a lot of ways. Future site to a Pagliacci. That they have not actually confirmed. Future site to the new home of Dick's, eventually a Cafe Vita, and literally nothing else.
Oh, no. Oh, dear.
How I'm just quickly making up businesses that I want to be in Renton.
It was, three short weeks ago that we were toasting to the Seahawks as division champions, but things have taken a dark turn.
Future site to a Cuban sandwich shop.
One that we mostly recapped in our 2020 season review with third Pelton brother, Ben Baldwin of The Athletic Seattle, that came out Monday morning. But that was before Pete Carroll delivered a tour de force media appearance on Monday, just really doubling down on everything. So we're going to get to that at the end.
That was the buttoned up version of the Seahawks year in review. Look, if we're being honest, they're basically in Newcastle. Calling it Renton is even like, that's Ooh. A stretch. You know what I mean? They're almost, they spend more time in Bellevue, I heard. That was the buttoned up version of the Seahawks year in review. This is the one where we're letting loose a little bit, starting with our beer of the week, which we are going to be drinking.
We're back to Fremont Brewery for the first time in a while here. And this time, trying their Dream City Vienna style lager, which I'm excited about because I recently watched the movie Before Sunrise.
Oh, wow. Did you? I've been wanting to watch that movie Before Sunrise that came out 20 plus years ago. I've been meaning to check that out.
You haven't gotten to that one just yet?
Yeah.
It's not as good as Before Sunset is my analysis because I watched both of those.
Okay. Before Sunset was first or Before Sunrise was first?
Before Sunrise was first, Before Sunset is second.
Oh, and you prefer the sequel?
I do.
Wow, we've got an Empire Strikes Back type situation. Those are comparable movies, right?
Very similar, yes. Uh-huh. Very similar plot lines. The part at the end where Ethan Hawke ends up in carbonite is my favorite part.
Off to a good start.
The Dream City Vienna style lager features Bohemian Pils, Munich, and Victory malts with Hallertau and Mittelfroh hops, aroma of biscuit and other cereals with caramel and honey sweet aromatics, followed by some floral, a gently sweet flavor, which lingers moderately with slight bitterness in its light body.
Now, did I hear you say victory hops?
I did say that, so that's not very appropriate for this week's pod, I guess.
Or any sports team in the city of Seattle.
Well, just the ones that are currently playing. There's lots of victories among the teams that are out of season.
There we go. To the storm. As always.
We got a storm update this week.
There we go.
They're on the rundown.
Oh, Lord.
I have no toast to get to. There was nothing to toast to this week.
Well, a toast of all of us for making it through that press conference, which we will be coming back to at the end of this podcast. But before then, is there any Seattle food news?
Well, there is a Seattle food update because last week we tried out the new Addo 206 menu. We hadn't been to Addo for an extended period of time since back over the summer, but I had to go. And the famous Cousin Katie also jumped into our chat and was like, I'm going to go. Do you people want anything? So I just ended up going and picking it up for the group of us. But there was sold by the Lechoncito ramen, which is a Puerto Rican spin on ramen with Puerto Rican pork broth, sazon pork belly and pork shoulder, yuca, noodles, chicharron, and achiote oil. This we both got this. It was outstanding.
Wow. I don't disagree. It was a unique ramen in a lot of ways. And I think the thing that stood out to me, it was very red, right? It was like a red ramen. Yep. And the thing that stood out to me was the pork, how thick and delicious it was. It was definitely up there with, you know, it's been a while since we did our search for Seattle's best ramen. Who knows how long this Husky basketball season is. We might have to do a part two this year. But it was maybe the best meat that we've had in any ramen.
Oh, I don't think there's any question. It's the best chashu.
Now, if I had to lodge a complaint, the reason this is not a 10 out of 10 ramen, it's more like an 8 out of 10 ramen, was the spice level was basically nothing. And I think that really hurt this particular ramen. I didn't have any sort of good spice in the house to add to it as far as a sauce. So I put Taco Bell hot sauce packets into it. And I'm not going to lie, it worked. But I would have preferred it to have been a more natural spice from the ramen itself, rather than having to go south of the border for the spice on the ramen.
I still think that there was plenty of flavor there.
You need flavor plus spice. I suppose. It's got to say hot.
I definitely came around on the hot, you know, ramen over the course of our search, but I still think this was great.
I mean, the reason that, oh my God, what is the location that won? Look, I haven't been to the city of Seattle in like
oink
53 weeks. We were bordering on a full year since I've been to the city of Seattle.
That can't be true, kidding?
No, not actually. The oink ramen, the reason that it won was because of the spice that it had, right? That oink ramen, which it had the perfect mix of all flavors. And this was just missing a little bit. It was so close because it was excellent ramen otherwise. And I really liked how unique it was. I mean, it was a great effort. To me, we're kind of Addo stands at this point, right?
Of course.
We've been there for almost everything they've done post-pandemic.
Well, I mean, Eric Rivera is doing a lot of different things. So I would not say almost everything. Because I think the 206 is a specific subsection of everything they're doing there. And we have tried a lot of different stuff that they've done through that specifically.
But I think this was the best thing that we've had from Addo.
Quite possibly so. I would say I would agree. And when we only tried the ramen, that's not all that's on the menu. There's a variety of Puerto Rican inspired, because that's Eric Rivera's background, things on the menu. The famous Cousin Katie and her husband had both the Addo hot sauce wings and the adobo tots casserole. Mm-hmm. Which sounded quite exciting in their own right. Mm-hmm.
That's a family recipe.
Apparently the wings are hot. That's what the famous Cousin Katie's husband, Ben, said. That was his review. But definitely well worth checking out, I would say. While we're on the topic of food, are we going to start our search next week?
For what? I'll search for anything. You tell me what. I'll be there and I'll search for it. Tell me what we're searching for.
No one has ever expressed any feedback about this to us on Twitter or via email. But
people would have to listen to express feedback in.
That's fair. The listeners expressed some other feedback, but not about this summer's food search specifically. And I feel like we should just start searching for Seattle's best fried chicken now, because it turns out, A, there's a lot of fried chicken out there. And B, there's a lot of national fried chicken chains out there if we want to like make that an extended part of the search, which could be fun in its own right.
I like it. Absolutely. I mean, I like it. Including the national chains. Let's do two brackets, right? Let's do Seattle's best chicken and let's do a national bracket that we intersperse, because it was Wendy's who said that they ended the chicken wars. I saw in an advertisement.
Now, that was relating specifically to chicken sandwiches. And one thing we have to discuss here is I don't think chicken sandwiches are eligible.
No. You're telling me chicken sandwiches aren't going to be eligible for the search?
We've already done a search for Seattle's best sandwich. Like that, they fell under that.
Oh, Lord.
Maono is still eligible, obviously. But it's going to be either the chicken strips or their classic fried chicken, as opposed to the Maono chicken sandwich.
You're telling me we're doing a search for Seattle's best chicken for the next foreseeable future, and I'm not going to be able to get chicken sandwiches?
No one said you can't get chicken sandwiches.
I could just... I don't agree with this. It can't be just about... The chicken sandwich is like the base way that people are eating chicken now.
All right, well, maybe the listener will have to weigh in on this.
Are you not familiar with the chicken wars that Wendy's just ended?
I just don't. I mean, I don't know. I've still never had the Wendy's spicy chicken sandwich.
Exactly. This is your opportunity to do so.
I'm intrigued to try it. Maybe the listener can weigh in, but we've already chosen Seattle's.
Maybe we exclude Maono. How about that? Does that make you feel better if Maono can't be part of this conversation?
Again, I think Maono should be part of this conversation for the chicken strips and or the fried chicken.
Okay, how about that? Maono can't enter. This is a new rule in Pelton Cast
searches. Past winners are ineligible?
Past winners are ineligible for other searches. Until
we get to the Tournament of Champions, which we're going to do at some point.
I can't wait until the Tournament of Champions.
The bracket of brackets. But anyway, I just don't think there's a scenario where we're going to be sitting there in July and be like, oh, damn, we ran out of fried chicken, dude. Like, we started too early. What a huge mistake. Like, that's never going to happen.
No. This should be an epic search. I agree.
I can't wait to get started.
Absolutely. Okay, but can we agree that we can include chicken sandwiches?
All right, I will concede that we can include chicken sandwiches.
There we go. In the same way that when we did Seattle's best burrito / taco. Burritos and tacos are different foods in a lot of ways, right? But we lump them all together for that conversation. We're going to do the same for chicken. So we're going to have fried chicken strips and fried chicken competing with chicken sandwiches, which I think is going to be a pretty interesting search.
Now, the next question is where to start this search.
Well, maybe let's make an effort to try to get both when we're going to places that have both. And let's try to take a holistic view of this, except for Maono, where we will not judge the chicken sandwich.
We might eat it. We might enjoy it, but we will not judge based on it.
Yes. Yes.
I think there is only one place to start this search.
Wow. Okay.
And that place is Zell's. It is Seattle's defining fried chicken. Am I wrong?
All right. I'll give it to you. I mean, I stand a little bit more for Heaven Sent. This is sort of
obviously.
Like,
this we'll is get into it.
Like, yeah. A Paseo versus, what is the new Paseo called? Un Bien. Yeah. Paseo versus Un Bien conversation, right? We've got Zell's versus Heaven Sent. That's a good conversation to have. And I wonder if, should we save it to be able to do both in the same week when at all, when we did the Un Bien and Paseo in the same week conversation.
I suppose we can consider doing that, yes.
Or we do it this week. We just start out with a bang and we have both Heaven Sent. I mean, the nearest Heaven Sent is very far away from here, right?
That is correct.
This is fucking ridiculous, right? I'm in Renton, Washington, home of everything but the Seahawks. And it used to be home to a beautiful Heaven Sent, right? The best of Heaven Sents. And now it's gone. Take it from me. Like,
I mean, I think you have to take that up with the good people of Renton because apparently not enough of them were eating there.
Bad process.
It looks like the nearest location is Lake City. Lake City.
They put a city in the lake?
All right, well, maybe we won't start there then after all, but we will definitely be getting into that, and we will definitely be starting our search next week. So
the chicken wars commence!
As usual, be sure to send us the spots you want to make sure we hit as part of this search.
Wow, we're finally doing it. I mean, we did sort of like an informal search for Seattle's best chicken last summer, which meant that we ate a fuckload of chicken.
It was Seattle's best new chicken sandwich, because it was the summer of chicken sandwiches.
And we're going to have to hit all of those places again. Are you up for this?
Well, I don't know. We got to figure out whether Jack's Chicken Shack is operational at all. Mm. But are the other places, yes.
There's so many chefs I want to have on this podcast. You say that, I'm like, let's get Jack on. Let's just ask Jack, right? What are we doing here?
Every
let's
time,
get Eric Rivera
Every time
on.
I reference that. I don't know if we have that kind of pull.
We can get Sue Bird or Shard Lewis, right? Pat Cashman, but we can't get Eric Rivera.
We could get Sue Bird. I don't know if we can actively get Sue Bird. She's going on a lot of big podcasts now. I don't know if
Sue is leaving you on red now.
The Supergirl glow up is all too
wow.
real.
Wow. You, we could get Supergirl. Oh my God.
It was a different time. She wasn't the kind of celebrity she is now. She wasn't getting people elected. But that actually was what we should have toasted to. I didn't even think about it. That's what we should have toasted to is and the WNBA players who put their efforts behind electing Reverend Raphael Warnock to the Senate to oust Kelly Loeffler, the part owner of the Atlanta Dream, who was an outspoken critic of the WNBA's Black Lives Matter movement this summer. And, you know, the fact that the playing a role in retaking the Senate for the Democratic Party, I mean, that's so much bigger than anything that, you know, these players have accomplished off the on the court, and they've accomplished an amazing amount on the court.
Well, and also alongside that, definitely have to recognize the work of Stacey Abrams and
for sure
the people in and the candidates themselves, John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock, and also
I think that goes without saying that the candidates were involved.
But I'm just saying the credit is due in a lot of different places here. You know, this is generation style change that's happening in the state of Georgia in particular, but for all of those folks and the WNBA to have played a role whatsoever is pretty incredible. And when you said that Kelly Loeffler has been outspoken against the WNBA, it's like you could have just stopped right there. And it's pretty wild that Kelly Loeffler was even involved, owns a WNBA team, and it feels like is so opposed to what the league has stood for from the players. It is pretty incredible.
It seems possible that she wasn't as opposed to it before that she was appointed to that Senate seat and then was doing what she thought would help her keep that Senate seat.
Times are changing, Kelly Loeffler.
It didn't
the
work.
Times, they are changing. Look, Hallmark wants their money back, Kelly Loeffler. But also the voters from the state of Georgia. And what an incredible job they did waiting in long lines, you know, dealing with what Stacey Abrams had to deal with, I think in 2016, when she was running for governor. Or was that was 2018?
2018, yes.
When Stacey Abrams was running for governor and the voter oppression that is deeply rooted in Georgia and the South, overcoming that and those voters waiting in line to cast those votes for those candidates, it was an incredible feat all around and a rebuke of what somebody like Kelly Loeffler stood for. And hopefully the Atlanta Dream will be freed from Kelly Loeffler as being part of that ownership group soon. I can't remember a time when there was such disdain for an owner within the league.
You can remember one time that particular owner was ousted pretty quickly in a way that didn't happen with Kelly Loeffler. And that's what caused the WNBA players to realize, you know, hey, if we can't force her out of the league, the least we can do is get her out of the Senate.
There we go.
So, anyways, that again is why Super is too big for the Pelton cast now.
We'll see.
Should we talk about the NBA? It's time for our NBA Seattle update, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. Because Pagliacci is always on time, but NBA expansion might not be on time.
Oh my God.
Okay,
what's the latest with the NBA? People are asking for an update on where this sits. I think there's a lot of conversation coming from a lot of different places, both locally within Seattle and Jenny Durkin saying something earlier this week, and also a national perspective with people with sources within the league. And I think it's a little bit difficult to process, other than the fact that there's steam, exactly where this conversation sits.
Yeah, I think we still need a little more reporting to come forward, to come to light, to have, you know, kind of a where we stand episode. But the latest, as you mentioned, last week, Mayor Durkin told Chris Daniels of King 5 that she spoke with NBA Commissioner Adam Silver last month after he first opened the door to expansion and said she's, quote, pretty optimistic about the prospects. Here I thought was the key quote from Durkin's interview with Chris Daniels. I think he's not going to get ahead of the owners, referring there to Silver. They've got to make the decision there first. I think that him saying it publicly means that they are very seriously considering it. And if you look at how sports moves, I don't think it's going to be a long multi-year process. I think it can be a shorter process than that, but it might be, you know, more than 1 year. I think first you got to get the ownership group in line, and they've got to decide what an expansion team price could look like and how they choose the cities that goes to. As we know, there's also teams that are underperforming in the NBA, so they have to look at the economics in those cities and make sure the teams they have are competitive. So they've got to look top to bottom as they're coming out of COVID and went through a very different season than they had before.
All thoughts about Jenny Durkin are redacted here for the sake of the conversation.
Daniels also talked to Tim Leiwicki of OQ Group, who said that the Seattle Kraken are set up to become a dual operating group across the NBA shell and NBA if there's shared ownership, along the lines of Vulcan Sports and Entertainment, which once saw Kraken CEO Todd Leiwicki oversee both the Seahawks and the Portland Trailblazers.
Okay, so Tim Leiwicki is coming out and saying this. This isn't a third-party ownership group. This is the Kraken ownership group owning both of these teams in the same building, plus the building itself.
I mean, it probably wouldn't be exactly the same people in exactly the same percentages if it were a shared ownership situation, but certainly David Bonderman would be a part of both groups.
The principles would be the same or similar.
Correct. I mean, there might be big money elsewhere that is interested in investing in an NBA team and wasn't interested in investing in the NHL team, or, you know, maybe someone else takes a majority position because of the fact that David Bonderman has already done that on the NHL side. But the one thing that Leiwicki has been very confident about is they have the money there when the time is right. So my ESPN colleague Brian Windhorst wrote up a newser about Bear Durkin's comments, and an important line in there, I think, he wrote that league officials have stressed that expansion is still likely years away if it happens at all. And then on Friday, David Aldridge of The Athletic, the legend, wrote about the importance of bringing the NBA back to Seattle and righting the wrong of moving the Sonics to Oklahoma City in 2008. Some of the key reporting from that piece, this is quoting Aldridge, "The league likes to keep such things close to the vest, but trust me, the door is open for the first time in a long time. I would agree that there is discussion, but no decision. One governor," referring to one of the majority owners, said this week, a sentiment echoed by another governor. Another high-ranking team executive said it was unlikely any serious consideration of expansion would happen at least before the end of the 2021-22 season. So I think the sum total when we put together all this reporting in the past week is it still seems that there is a lot of steam, one of your favorite words, for expansion, but it doesn't seem like that timetable is as accelerated as it might have looked when we were talking about this a week ago.
They're just trying to make our bold predictions be wrong.
That's what I was going to say, yes. It doesn't necessarily dampen my enthusiasm about expansion in general that much, but if you were going to make a bold prediction about 2021, it doesn't look as good.
And the pieces that I take from that is, in the Windy piece, there's the "if it happens at all" there. You know, that sentence, I think it's doing a lot of work in that sentence, right? The "if it happens at all" is basically like, this could happen eventually, or it may happen never. And I think David Aldridge's reporting that you're talking about hints that this is probably maybe the "if it happens at all" is not as much part of the conversation. Do you think there's an element of the cat got out of the bag a little bit sooner than the NBA wanted it to? And potentially that was even because of do they want this to be a conversation right now? Is this because of, you know, potentially the Tim Leiwicki group is pushing this conversation and they're making it more public than the NBA is looking for? Plus the Jenny Durkin quote.
I mean, we played the clips on the podcast 2 weeks ago. Adam Silver was very openly talking about expansion in a way that he hasn't before. Adam Silver didn't do that by accident.
Okay.
It didn't happen by mistake. It was a strategic plan.
Why then the walking this back, though? Or why then the dampening of the conversation?
My read on the situation is that Silver may have brought it up publicly in part because he wants this discussion to get enough the necessary support among the owners. That there is certainly a contingent of owners that is looking at this as a way to, you know, cover up the losses that they've suffered due to the pandemic, but that maybe not all of the owners are on board with that and trying to create more excitement about this and, you know, the enthusiasm that inevitably would be generated here in Seattle and, you know, in Las Vegas. Although one other thing that Aldridge noted is that he was the first person to raise the idea of potentially only adding one team and going with an odd number again, which is something the NBA did for a long period of time. They were at first 21 teams, I believe, after the Mavericks. Then they went 23-25 with the two rounds of expansion in 89 and 90. 27 when they added the Raptors and Grizzlies in 95, or 20, I guess that was, I'm too off here. They went to 29 with the Raptors and Grizzlies, and it wasn't until 2004 when they added the Bobcats, now the Hornets, that they got back to an even number for the first time in, you know, I think since the Mavericks.
Wow. They're much less concerned about having even numbers than, say, the NFL is.
Right, because you don't have to have everyone playing every night in the same way. I still think it's more likely than not that if you expanded, you would go to 32. But that was interesting to see them that raised as a possibility.
Huh, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. Let me ask you a question here. The number has been set at approximately $2.5 billion for an expansion team. Is there a dollar amount that is too high? Or is there a dollar amount that you think could possibly get those remaining owners, you know, over the finish line, right? Like, that's the number that everybody has in their minds, but what if it's $3 billion? You know, is that extra $500 million? When you're having these conversations we're talking about right now, obviously on a granular level, $500 million is a ridiculous amount of money. But when you're already talking about spending $2.5 billion, what's the difference in spending another $500 million?
And if you're taking out of, well, either way, I mean, you've already spent $1.2 billion on an arena. You know, if it's the Chris Hansen group building a new arena in Soto, that's going to be well north of a billion, obviously. So, yeah, in the context of that, it doesn't seem like as much.
It doesn't feel like this is a thing that's been brought up, though. Like, they've just named a number and are like, that's the number. Well, if you're worried about getting those extra owners over the finish line, how about more money rather than fan interest? Why couldn't it be $3 billion? Why couldn't it be $3.5 billion?
I mean, at some point there's a walkaway number, certainly. Like, everyone's got a walkaway number. The $2.5 billion is probably more of a goal than it is, you know, well, we can be certain of this. But I would imagine that number has been communicated to prospective ownership groups, too, that they have an idea of what's coming. So.
And they haven't balked at the idea of that.
Not that we know of.
Interesting.
I think it's certainly easier to get here in Seattle than it is in Vegas. That, or in whatever the second city is, just in terms of the financial possibilities for a team here.
In any other market. So you're not sure. I mean, obviously, we're only looking at this from the Seattle perspective. You don't know if $2.5 billion is out there in Las Vegas.
I don't.
That makes sense.
So, well, I don't know.
I just don't know what other info could come out about this, right? Like, you know.
To go back to the Aldridge quote from the league governor, there is discussion but no decision. Well, they're going to keep discussing it. So, you know, I think it probably is still relatively early in that process from the standpoint of league ownership.
Are there other key dates to point to going forward where these conversations will happen a little bit more officially? Or is it kind of just an ongoing conversation?
There probably are key dates, but we do not yet know them.
Okay. You know, without having, I think in the past, an all-star break, usually it would be the time period that you kind of circle for big league news coming out. Obviously, they're planning on an all-star break this year, but it presumably would look very different than it has in the past.
There's been some conversation about possibly playing an all-star game in a different form. I would assume the number of games that have been postponed affects that, because the time they've set aside as a midseason break may have to be used to make up those postponed games.
Okay. So. Well, we'll continue monitoring the situation. I mean, it's good that we're talking about this. You know, I think for us, when we look at the spring, we're going to talk about Husky basketball here in a little bit. this is the number one story that we're focusing on. I mean, this is earth-shattering, this story, right? Having a new team, having basketball be played in the city of Seattle, like you mentioned, righting the wrongs of what were done with the team moving a decade plus ago, is still massive news. So any information that comes out about it, even though we've gone for a significant period of time without a lot of information, the fact that we're even having this conversation, I think, is important, and it feels like we're moving in the right direction. Seeing David Aldridge say that the door is open, this is fucking huge.
Yeah, and consistent with, you know, everything that had been reported previously. So speaking of expansion and speaking of the Kraken, they made a couple of hires last week, adding Jason Botterill is assistant GM and Norm McIver is director of player personnel. Botterill spent the previous three seasons as GM of the Buffalo Sabres before being fired in June. He got the GM opportunity in Buffalo at age 40 after a decade in the Pittsburgh Penguins front office. And he worked with Kraken GM Ron Francis as part of the team building Canada's roster for the 2019 World Championship. So, you know, they built some chemistry there. As for McIver, he enjoyed a 13-season NHL career before joining the Chicago Blackhawks front office in 2006, rising to assistant GM, but had been demoted to director of player personnel last summer, setting the stage for the lateral move to the Kraken in the same position. Seemed like, you know, he just was kind of on the outs with the current management after being seen as something of a rising star previously in the front office. He played with Francis for the Penguins, so a connection there. In a very different bit of Kraken news, Chris Daniels, who's been busy, reported Monday that the Kraken training facility, the Northgate Ice Center, which is currently under construction, was damaged by debris, apparently from cranes demolishing the former Nordstrom at Northgate on Sunday. Thankfully, no one was hurt in the accident, which damaged the west wall of the building. A statement from the team concluded, "The Kraken are working to assess the damage. We are confident it will not impact our opening timeline for hockey operations," which is important because they're going to need to be ready to go in that building next summer after the expansion draft.
I feel like there's something kind of poetic about something that's so old Seattle in a Nordstrom building damaging the Kraken's training facility.
If there's good news here, besides
a brick and mortar location being demolished, yes. Right? A brick and mortar location being demolished and destroying the training facility of the new hockey team that's moving to Seattle.
The past of Northgate and the future of Northgate coming colliding, literally. The other good news, besides, of course, the fact that no one was injured, is that, so apparently it affected the west end of the building, which is where the public ice facility is going to be, rather than the team facility is part of it. So, you know, if that gets delayed a little bit, it's not as big of a deal as, you know, making sure that players have a place to go next summer.
It really shows something about your worldview that the public ice facility being damaged meant that was a positive news for you.
I'm just saying that
instead of the people who built a $1 billion arena for a hockey team,
if it's a couple months
delayed,
it only
affects the citizens.
I think that the citizens will probably be fine if it's September instead of July or whatever it is. Also, may not be able to do any of these things because, reminder, we are still in the midst of a pandemic. Gathering indoors, not a great idea at this point. On the Sounders front, Ives Galarsep of SBI Soccer reported Tuesday that the Sounders and Brian Schmetzer had reached agreement on a new contract. Still no official announcement, GM Garth Lagerwey said in response, "I have never had any doubt that Brian would eventually sign."
There we go. How are you not getting, you're like, I have no toasts. And then throughout the podcast, you just got more and more toasts. Or you can't toast until it's done, until it's signed.
Yeah, until the ink is dry.
All right. Fine. Through we'll every segment, you're going to be like, here's another toast that we could have.
Also on the Sounders coaching front, Stephen Goff of the Washington Post reported that Sounders assistant Gonzalo Pineda was offered the DC United manager job, but was unable to agree to a contract and pulled out of that search. So sounds like he will be back with the Sounders next season, although sure to get a head coaching job at some point soon. We discussed the Storm's work off the court, but also some off-season news, or not coming news at least. The Storm must decide by Thursday whether to use the core designation on one of their free agents this offseason. Starters Sue Bird, Alicia Clark, and Natasha Howard are all unrestricted free agents. Bird is surely only playing in Seattle, and Clark might not have offers for the $215,000 supermax that the core designation would guarantee for 1 year. So it's probably a matter of whether or not the Storm decides to use it on Howard. Either way, to get the $215,000 supermax, Howard would have to either stay with the Storm or go elsewhere via sign-in trade. The most other teams can offer her outright as a free agent is $190,000. But she might be interested in a larger offensive role elsewhere, so that's why you'd want to consider using the core designation. The downside to using the core designation, which is very similar to the franchise tag in football, is that it can only be used on one player at a time, and it lasts the life of any new contract signed while cored. So if the Storm then signed Howard to a multi-year deal, they might not have it available to use next offseason when both Jewel Lloyd and Brianna Stewart become unrestricted free agents.
Is there really a question whether Jewel Lloyd or Brianna Stewart re-sign with the Storm?
Probably not. And the Storm can also try to sign those players to extensions as soon as free agency opens, which will be on Friday. It officially opens, although typically we don't see any signings in the WNBA until they can be made official on February 1st. But my guess is that they probably will use the core designation on Howard. That's what I did in our mock WNBA offseason.
There we go.
For her hoop stats. First of its kind.
That was your first ever WNBA mock offseason. You, Nate Duncan, Danny LaRue on her hoop stats. I love it.
We've already got over. They were not involved. It was just me as the crossover. Fittingly so.
Oh, Lord.
So we'll know more about that by the time we next podcast and have a better idea of the Storm's plans in free agency. Unhappily, UW women's basketball, unable to take their trip to Arizona as well as the one to LA scheduled for next weekend, both those sets of games postponed due to recent COVID-19, quote, impacts in the UW program. Mm. Sunday's game.
It's unhappy that they had impacts within the program, but
yeah.
Not having to play basketball for free during the middle of a pandemic is probably net positive.
I mean, not for whichever players or members of the coaching staff or support staff tested positive, but
that's the negative part.
I get your point. Sunday's game versus Arizona State had already been postponed due to COVID-19 developments in the Sun Devils.
Oh, God.
Which is weird, because to me, developments is like, hey, we developed a vaccine.
Oh, Lord. Wait, pause.
Herd immunity might be...
No, okay, go ahead. Before going to the
herd immunity might... Herd immunity might take longer than we thought. That's a development.
Oh my God. At Arizona State, they only have herb immunity.
Nope. He's not been the coach there for many, many years.
Still.
Do you know who the coach is at Arizona State?
Oh, God. Bobby Hurley?
You just maintained the herb immunity. Bobby Hurley is indeed the coach of the Sun Devils, yes.
I was just making a clever herb joke.
Define clever.
Before we get into Husky basketball, I do have to shout out my side beer for today. To get myself through talking about Husky men's basketball, I need more than 16 ounces of beer. And have to shout out the Southern Resident Killer Whale Chinook Hazy IPA from Two Beers Brewing Company. Purchased at Bartell Drugs. This is excellent beer.
Have we drank that on the pod officially?
It would have been a while ago if we had, but I gotta say, I'm having that and the Fremont beer, and I mean, a hazy IPA is pretty tough to beat. The only beer that really beats a hazy IPA is a fresh hop IPA, of course, which I was able to scoop up in a late rising batch of Koichi Canyon this week, which was top notch, but the hazy IPA is pretty excellent.
We also are having a hazy IPA from Fremont next week. So,
wow,
yeah.
Spoiler alert.
The listener drinks.
What are you
going
to tell people the rating of our chicken for next week too?
I don't know that yet.
We don't even know what the chicken is. 8 out of 10? Can you believe that?
So you'd have men's basketball.
Oh, God.
A 91-75 loss Thursday at Stanford. I don't know why it's so funny.
Just the... I have not watched a minute of UW men's basketball this year. I literally have not seen this team play. When you update me on these things, this is the first that I learn of these games happening, and I swear to God, I am so proud of that.
I flipped over a couple of times to the Stanford game on Thursday. I did not watch a minute of the other one. They fell behind 12-0 early to the Cardinal in Santa Clara and never got any closer than 9 the rest of the half, playing the game, against a team playing without both starting guards due to injury. Stanford freshman Zaire Williams recorded the second triple-double in program history with 12 points, 12 rebounds, and 10 assists. The Huskies were more competitive in an 84-78 loss Saturday at Cal, buying 27 points from Eric Stevenson, who knocked down 6 three-pointers, and a career-high 18 from Jamal Bey, but still missed their best chance for a win for a while.
I mean, you saying that they were more competitive against a team that you described as possibly the worst in the Pac-12, and one of the worst teams in the country, but they still lost.
Well, one of the worst in a Power 5, yeah. But I think we know which was the worst.
I was going to say, when you're talking about, look, somebody's got to be the worst in the Power 5 here, and all of a sudden...
There might be somebody worse elsewhere. I don't know about that. Or the Power 6, really, in basketball. This weekend does not really look promising for the Huskies to get their first conference win after an 0-5 start as they visit the LA schools. USC off to an 8-2 start after sweeping the Arizona schools on the road last weekend. Their lone losses have come to UConn in Uncasville, Connecticut, in Brackettville, and or Bubbleville, or whatever they called it, and home versus Colorado on New Year's Eve. Freshman center Evan Mobley, a likely top three pick, has been a dominant shot-blocking force and is making 62% of his two-point attempts for the Trojans. Meanwhile, since losing their opener at San Diego State, the Bruins have won 9 of their last 10 games, with the lone loss coming to Ohio State in Cleveland as part of the Champions Classic, the last unbeaten team in Pac-12 play at 5-0, despite losing senior forward Chris Smith. And that's always tough to see with Chris Smith, to an ACL tear on New Year's Eve.
Did the Minnesota Timberwolves Chris Smith also go to UCLA?
No, I think he went to UConn.
Oh.
So that brings us to the topic this week.
Oh, God.
Is this the worst team in UW men's basketball history? So a little background. The worst conference record in school history was the 2-16 record in Lorenzo Homar's final season as head coach with Markel Fultz on the roster. Though that team was competitive in non-conference play and won 9 total games, the fewest total wins since 1918 were 5 in Bob Bender's first season, 1993-94, where the team went 3-15 in conference play and 5-22 overall. This year's KenPom projections have the Huskies finishing with 5 wins on average, which seems incredibly optimistic. SportsReference.com's simple rating system goes back to the 1949-50 season, which was a great one. And in that span, UW has rated worse than the average team across all of Division I 4 times. 1953-54, 1963-64, 1965-66, and 2001, when the Huskies went 4-14 in conference play and 10-20 overall during my freshman year at UW. The very worst rated of those teams by simple rating system on sportsreference.com was 1953-54, which went 8-18 overall. They were 0.6 points per game worse than the Division I average that year. This year's Huskies are currently 3.1 points per game worse than the Division I average, wow, according to simple rating system. So
what you're saying is yes.
So far is
a yes. They are on pace to be the worst UW men's basketball team in history.
They've got a couple months to avoid that, to regress to the mean, avoid that indignity, but it's not off to a strong start.
I just don't know where those wins come from. I mean, the idea of getting to 5 wins right now is fanciful, right? I mean, that would require 4 Pac-12 wins. And I just don't see those on the schedule at this point. The Markel Fultz team that you reference, they finished 2-16 And the second half of the season when Markel was out was pretty rough, but they were a better team than that. Like they were not a non-competitive team.
Yeah.
And I just, even more so than just how bad they are, they're bad and they're uninteresting and there's no hope. Like, there's really nothing on the horizon. I went and looked at the overall stats today of just who's scoring points for this team. And there's Quade Green, who leads the team in points. And then I think their second leading scorer is Jamal Bayet, a little over 7 points per game. Like, just looking at those numbers, and when you look at the Quade Green numbers even deeper, oh boy, it's just, there's nothing there, right? Like, the talent on the roster is non-existent, and I think we saw it coming. I don't know if we saw it coming quite as severely as it is, or as it has been.
No.
But I don't think we're particularly shocked by it, right? And I just don't know what can be done to turn both this season around and the program in general. Like, we're back to where we were at growing up with Husky basketball, which is they don't fucking matter. And they're not on the playing field.
I mean, which is odd because they did have 2 first-round picks a year ago and won the Pac-12 2 years ago. It's just how they could have fallen so far so quickly is pretty baffling.
It is recruiting classes.
I mean, yes, that's how it has happened. But I guess why is hard to understand.
It's because you don't recruit well in the state of Washington. Like, I don't know what to tell you when your best recruits are coming from upstate New York, literally the farthest place in the country from the city of Seattle. No, no. Like,
I mean, look, you know, football did once have a recruiting pipeline going into Boca Raton in Florida. I think that was
long term, and
distant.
You know what that led to? An 0-12 season. Like, when you have these things,
Let's not blame that on John Anderson and Charles Frederick, good sir.
But it's not about John Anderson and Charles Frederick. It's about the long term. The for UW sports, this is not true for every program in the country. For UW sports, you need to recruit really well regionally. They're not a national program. Basketball or football, right? They're not a national program. And if they're at this point where they're trying to get some of the best players from fucking Syracuse, New York, that's not going to work. And not being able to recruit in the state of Washington has not worked out well for this Husky team. And you have recruiting class after recruiting class that has been pretty devoid of talent. And having players go out early, I mean, it's the same thing that Lorenzo Romar suffered from. But this is a deeper chasm than anything that Lorenzo ever suffered.
Because you could think that you were a recruiting class away. And who knows what would have happened. Obviously, Michael Porter
they
got
They were
hurt.
A recruiting class away. Are you kidding me? I mean, the Michael Porter Jr. injury happens.
That's what it was
implied. It is a fluke injury. But, like, Lorenzo was building something. And there is nothing being built right now. Nothing at all. There's no next recruiting class, right?
Well, there is a new recruit, point guard Dominic Penn, who announced his commitment to UW and immediately will enroll for the winter quarter. Penn, originally part of the 2020 class, decided to reclassify for 2021 and was playing at Chattanooga Hamilton Heights Christian in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Before deciding to commit to the Huskies, he will be immediately eligible, but won't lose a season of eligibility because of this year's COVID-19 rules. Penn is the son of Boston College and Ohio State standout Scoony Penn, who is now an assistant with the Memphis Grizzlies. Penn was not particularly effective in the 2019
Nike
EYBL.
That's what I'd like to see.
Oh, no. Making 40% of his two-point attempts and 23% of his threes with an assist-to-turnover ratio barely better than one. He told 247sports.com about his commitment. What stands out about him, referring to Mike Hopkins, is the way he wants his guards to play. He likes guys who play hard and grimy. He likes how they play on the East Coast, and that's the way I play, and I feel like it works out, and it fits me perfect.
This, I just do not see how Mike Hopkins makes it. through this year.
I do see how Mike Hopkins makes it through this year. And as Christian Capel of The Athletic tweeted about last week, it's because the guaranteed, like the buyout would be that if the Huskies fired him, they still owe him all his guaranteed compensation, less whatever else he makes as a set off in a new job, which presumably would not be nearly as much. So you'd be looking at basically paying two coaches for some period of time with the athletic department that has been
to make up that money. If let's say you're a college basketball program, you've committed a lot of money to a coach. The best way that you can make that up, do you know what? I came up with this idea. Don't pay the players anything. $0.
Oh no.
Right? You pay the players nothing. That. There's a lot of money out there to pay coaches. You could pay 10 fucking coaches, right? If you pay the players nothing.
It turns out they can. Turns out they're already doing
that.
They absolutely can
and will. Maybe they won't this season. And look, Hop, he probably deserves another season, but presiding over
it. I did find it amusing that like the tweet that Christian Capel was replying to was someone saying like, what's the case for not firing him at the end of this season? I believe it was Matt Holt. And it's like, he is 2 years removed from being the Pac-12 coach of the year, back to back years. Like, I'm not that optimistic about the future of the program, but it's wild that you can't come up with one reason.
He maintained Lorenzo Romar's recruiting classes that were going to excel at UW.
All I know is I hope that everyone who wanted Lorenzo Romar fired is happy now. On that note, should we talk about the Seahawks?
Oh, God. I really can't believe what's happened to UW basketball, though. Right? Like, I take that back. They're in the Pac-12, which is an irrelevant conference when it comes to national college basketball. They can't recruit in the state of Washington, where there are good players, but have been pretty unable to do so. And they've had players who were good but not great leave early. And it's kind of the same recipe as what happened to Lorenzo Romar. Lorenzo had maybe even better players leaving early on him, but like players leaving after their freshman year who are going to be late first round picks or whatever is kind of the recipe for disaster for a smaller program like UW. And that's how you end up in a position like this. Look, if everybody came back, if Jaden McDaniels was there, if Isaiah Stewart was there, they'd probably be in an okay position. You know, the loss of Naz Carter, even though it was a good decision by the program to separate from Naz Carter, still meant that like they're losing a lot of the offense that they had. And that's it. You end up with a team that's not a competitive basketball team.
I mean, I think the difference, though, is like a big problem with the Romar teams is that they were super young because of the fact that these players and like Marquise Chris and DeJounte Murray were not guys who were recruited with the expectation that they were going to be one and done prospects. With Jaden McDaniels and Isaiah Stewart, you knew they were going to be one and done prospects. Like this year was probably always going to be a down year for the Huskies because of the way the recruiting classes fell, because they weren't going to want to commit a lot of their scholarships in as much as they were hoping to sign some of these big recruits in the 21 class. And they just didn't get almost any of those, just Jackson Grant from that class. So that's kind of where things went wrong. But I mean, like if you compare this to with the 17 team that went 2-16 in conference, in terms of experience in the country, they ranked, according to KenPom, they ranked 347th out of 352 teams.
They should have given Lorenzo another fucking year. That's the issue. We said this at the time.
I mean, we all agree that. We all agree that. But this year's team ranks 111th in experience. Like they're actually a relatively old team. It's just none of these players have gotten any better in the time they've been at UW, which is a problem.
And Lorenzo, I will say, Lorenzo was able to develop players. You consistently saw it. Players who went from being freshmen to being seniors who got better. Quincy Pondexter, right? John Brockman becoming a better player. Justin Dentman becoming a better player. Trey Simmons. over that time period, Lorenzo Romar developed basketball players and he turned them into NBA players. And I'm not sure if that's the thing that happened. Look, we all fucking know what happened. They fired him brashly when they shouldn't have, when there was an incredible recruiting class coming and Lorenzo needed one more year. It would have been a phenomenal year of Husky basketball. He would have made the NCAA tournament. It would have been hyped on it. And Lorenzo would still be the coach right now. And Paolo Banchero would be committed to UW. You could play out the alternate universe, and you know what that alternate... You think Lorenzo was losing Paolo? There's no fucking way. He was probably recruiting Paolo since he was 8 years old. Lorenzo went out and got players like that. Mike Hopkins can't recruit Paolo Banchero. He's like, I'm going to go fucking sign with Mr. Syracuse over here. Everybody knew when he took the job that he didn't belong as the UW coach. Nothing about it made sense. The process, top to bottom. Nothing about it made sense. Zone defense. It's garbage.
I mean, it worked very well when it had Matisse Thybulle, as it turns out. All right, should we talk about the Seahawks now?
Lorenzo Romar recruit.
Of course. So, again, we recorded Sunday night. Had some thoughts. Had some takes on the season that was. And then Pete Carroll goes on his weekly Pete Carroll show on ESPN Seattle Monday morning and holds a press conference subsequently, the wrap-up press conference in the media. And let's just read a few of these quotes.
Oh, God.
Let's start here. This is from the press conference. We have to run the ball better. Not even better, we have to run it more. We have to dictate what's going on with the people that we're playing, and that's one of the ways to do that. And I know that fans aren't really jacked about hearing that, but Russ knows it too. We need to be able to knock those guys into the scheme that we want to throw at.
I think we'll come back to this point of we can change offensively the scheme that the defense is playing against us.
No, let's just hit it now. I feel like let's not.
There's this idea that so basically playing two high safeties was the change that happened midseason against the Seahawks, right? The way to beat the Seahawks, the recipe was you play two safeties and you keep them back and you pressure Russell Wilson, which seemed to get
don't give up big plays.
And it seemed to get easier throughout the year. There's this idea that Pete Carroll has that basically if they run the ball, they can change the way that a defense is playing. But I think the thing that Pete Carroll is not grasping is that defensive coordinators have adjusted to the game and they've gotten smarter about it than he has. That's the thing, is if you want them to do that, they're not going to fucking do that, right? Like, you're saying it. You're literally saying in a press conference, this is what we want defenses to do. And he's not even saying that they want them to run the ball better. That's the thing that's wild to me. He's like, we want to run the ball more. Nobody was stopping them from running the ball more. All there was a lack of success running the ball. Look, I don't think either of us disagrees that if the Seahawks were able to run the ball, if they could have picked up 5-6 yards per carry, every carry, then do that. But it's not like it's an easy thing to do, or at least for this team, it wasn't an easy thing to do. The issue is not that they didn't run the ball enough. It's that they didn't run the ball effectively enough. And just doing that more doesn't change how a defense is playing. The defenses this year, the second half of the season, were both playing that scheme with the two safeties and stopping the run. So why would they change the scheme? Like, what about you're going to do over this offseason is going to change that? Because you're going to run the ball more? Because if I was at one of those defensive coordinators, I would fucking beg you to run that offense against me. If what you're telling me is you want to run more of what we saw in the second half of the season, I would say yes, please. I would be the goddamn Browns accepting that punt from the Steelers on Sunday night, saying thank you.
I mean, as Third Pelton brother Ben Baldwin pointed out on Twitter, we literally have a quote from Rams defensive coordinator Brandon Staley saying this in that Robert Mays Athletic piece that I referenced last week previewing the game. I know that the quickest way to lose is to give up explosions in the passing game, Staley said. It takes a lot of 4 and 5 yard runs to add up to a 50 yard pass. If you truly believe that explosions are how you lose in the NFL.
I was skeptical about Brandon Staley before this, but hearing that is like, damn, Brandon Staley actually knows what's up. He's like 28 fucking years old. Give me that shit. feed me it. Give me somebody who's 1/4 the age of Pete Carroll. Come on. All right. Sorry. Finish your quote.
If you truly believe that explosions are how you lose in the NFL, which Pete Carroll does, you really need to start there in your philosophical structure and how you construct your defense.
That's the thing, is Pete Carroll gets this. That's the real issue, is Pete Carroll actually fundamentally understands what the valuable plays are in the NFL. And that's what I keep coming back to, is he knows that not giving up big plays defensively is important, but he thinks that he can trick these defensive coordinators into giving up big plays because reasons, right? And it's just like,
because they're going to get frustrated by seeing their team get run on, because he gets frustrated by seeing his team get run on.
I don't know if that's necessarily untrue, but you have to be able to run the ball first. And it, when you have defensive coordinators like Brandon Staley, who say it takes a lot of 4 to 5 yard carries to add up to a 50 yard gain, is, this is football. This is what we've learned this season. Like I said to you last week, this is what we understand about football to be true. You give up a lot of garbage underneath to avoid giving up big plays because, like Brandon Staley said, it takes a lot of 4 to 5 yard carries to add up to a 50 yard gain. What else from Pete Carroll?
Oh boy. As we came on defensively,
oh God,
I adjusted us some to make sure we were really taking care of the football, knowing we could win some games by the way we were playing defense, which you've seen us do that for 10 years around here. I don't care about the numbers or the stats. That's not important. It's fun to have numbers, but we've got to win games. Look at what happened at the end. We tightened things down, and we won 4 games that we had to win a division, and that's what it took.
Literally... I hate how the schedule played out, because Pete Carroll, he got his results without the process. And that's why it's an issue. He's saying they played such horseshit process over the second half of the season and they happened to win games because they were playing Carson Wentz and the Eagles, refusing to play Jalen Hurts, Dwayne Haskins and the Washington football team, again, who was cut a little over a week later. They lost to fucking Colt McCoy. They played CJ Beathard and the 49ers. They played a broken Jared Goff and the Rams and happened to get a goal line stop to win that game. They beat a lot of really fucking bad teams and they patted themselves on the back doing it. And they didn't crush those. Oh, and the Jets in between, right?
Yeah, the disrespect to Sam Darnold, to not mention him here.
The big win that they had during that time period was the team that should have gotten the first pick in the draft because they should have been tanking, but played slightly better in the second half of the season. Like, they played a lot of terrible teams over the second half. Honestly, this schedule lined up so terribly for the Seahawks and process to break Pete Carroll's mind. I wish that they had this at the beginning or any other period. Maybe they could have had the fucking all these bad teams sprinkled throughout the year. Right? Like,
it would have been bad whenever it happened. So yes, they would have had to been sprinkled in. Yes.
Because he didn't understand why they were winning these games. When you're beating the Washington football team by how many points did they win that game? Like, we're stressing about beating Dwayne Haskins, who is just about to be cut. You lost to goddamn Colt McCoy, right? Like, how do you take a victory lap over that? You have Russell Wilson, you have the Seahawks roster, and you lost to the Giants, dude. Have a wake-up call about what the season actually looked like. Just because you played a lot of very terrible teams in the row doesn't mean that things were better. And that's the hardest part to grasp, is, again, we come back to this, it is outcome-based versus process-based. And the process was fucking terrible over the second half of the season. They lost to the Giants. Like, that's one that we keep kicking ourselves about. But you know what? I'm happy that they lost to the Giants, because they didn't fucking deserve to win the game. Their process was bad, so they shouldn't have won. And you have to give credit to the Giants for winning that game, because they came in here and they beat up on a really stupid old coach.
Wow.
Is that not true? They beat up on a coach who doesn't understand how you win football games. He literally does not. He looked at this stretch of games against horrible teams, 3 NFC East teams, one of the worst conferences ever, and they lost one of them, and the Jets. and he patted himself on the back for winning those games. They played no good teams other than the Rams during that time period.
And certainly no good offenses. I mean,
ugh. And then we talked about as the defense came on. No fucking shit, the defense came on. When you're playing exclusively terrible offenses, all of a sudden the defense came on. God.
As we talked about with Ben on the season review pod, it seems to be a dramatic overreaction to the turnover issues they had midseason, which were partially random and partially caused by playing from behind. And that Pete Carroll doesn't understand that although turnovers have historically been an important factor in winning games, so too has been moving the ball. And this here, to me, I know you love a good I think you should leave gif or meme.
You're going to get this right this time?
This was the, oh my God, he admit it, of Pete Carroll's press conference. Like, we suspected the offense was fucked up in the second half of the season because of Pete Carroll, and then he just came out and said it.
And again, took credit for it. Can you read the quote? Or is that part of the quote?
I mean, that was the quote.
Wait. What did he exactly say?
As we came on defensively, I adjusted us some to make sure we were really taking care of the football.
I thought he said he helped out with the offense. There was a different quote.
That may have been a paraphrase. That I don't think that was a direct quote, as it turns out.
Okay, so we talked about this yesterday, but it became very apparent today, and he actually took credit for this. I'm just going to hold on. I want to pull up a Pro Football Reference here.
I mean, I want to talk about the part of it where he says, I don't care about the numbers or the stats. That's not important. Like, this is something where, like, Pete Carroll has become convinced that looking at total yardage is, you know, because you can give up
points
a lot of yards
is a
and
stat,
lose.
Though. Wait, let me read the score for the first half of the year here. We've got 38, 35, 38, 31, 27, 34, 37, 34. That is the first eight games of the season. Do you think that they topped 30 points again in the second half of the season?
Yes.
One time. Seven out of eight times in the first half of the season, and one out of eight times in the second half of the season. This is the defense that Pete Carroll helped. Right? Like, I don't understand how you can be Pete Carroll and look at these raw numbers and say, but again, I guess what you're saying is he doesn't actually care about stats, right? The amount of times, how many times do you think they topped 400 yards in the second half of the season?
He thinks that correlation is causation. So the fact that the defense was so much better when they stopped throwing the ball as much as in the second half was because they stopped throwing the ball as much in the second half, rather than, as you pointed out, because of the fact that they played a number of very poor offenses in the second. And the defense did legitimately get better. They also added Carlos Dunlap.
They added Carlos Dunlap. They had a healthy Jamal Adams. They got DJ Reed solidified as the second cornerback. Like, all these things, those should be things that Pete Carroll sees, though, right? He's the fucking coach. He should see that these things are happening and that the offense is playing like absolute dog shit. Like, I don't get how you could see these. Okay, so they gained 400 plus yards.
But again, Pete Carroll's going to reject total yards. The problem is he's also rejecting yards per play, which is a stat that it turns out does correlate to winning in a way that total yards doesn't necessarily.
It just wins are a bad stat. In the same way that looking at quarterback wins is a bad stat to look at, they gained 400 plus yards one time. All of these numbers managed to happen against the Jets, and I swear to God, they just barely got there against the Jets, too. It wasn't a good game, right? Like,
I'm willing to concede that was a good game.
It's the goddamn Jets. Even then, did they beat the Jets as much as they should have? I don't know. Points-wise, yes, but in any other facet of the game, did they? We're just going to isolate that one game, the one time that they played well. They scored 12 fucking points against the Giants the week before, and this is the fixed Pete Carroll offense? Like, it's egregious. It's fireable, is what happened here. Like, and we could talk a little bit more about Pete Carroll in general after that. But, like, what Pete Carroll did to this offense, if what you're going to say is Pete Carroll intervened midseason to stop turnovers, and what he did is he basically neutralized the most valuable asset that you have as a franchise, which is Russell Wilson, right? Russell Wilson is more valuable than Pete Carroll. He's more valuable than John Schneider. He's more valuable than anything else other than the franchise. And what you did as a coach is you made him bad. And all these people coming out being like, well, Russell Wilson is bad. I even see that Mike Sean Duggar post where he's like, Russell Wilson's lows are a lot lower than you thought, or whatever. His basement is a lot lower than we thought. It's like, fuck that. Fuck all of these things. Russell Wilson deserves zero blame. In fact, I'm telling you right now.
That's you're going.
What, how can you tell me if you're Russell Wilson and what you have is your goddamn coach in your ear, who the only coach you've ever played with, and he's like, no turnovers, no turnovers, no turnovers. You look at some of the misses he had. We're talking about Russell Wilson, who threads balls into tiny spaces, and all of a sudden he doesn't want to throw a pick. So he does nothing wrong. I don't think not wanting to throw a pick is the reason
that he missed Will Disley on a third down.
I think Russell Wilson got legitimately broken by what Pete Carroll was telling him this season and the offense. Pete Carroll made Russell Wilson bad. Russell Wilson deserves precisely zero.
When you make these ridiculous over-the-top arguments, you force rational people to disagree with you.
Why then does it exactly line up with the second that Pete Carroll intervened to fix the offense?
I mean, I don't know that it
did. Russell Wilson decide to get bad? He was excellent before.
His completion percentage over expected was also way down.
It's
and that's
because
not ever
he was
happened
scared
before
of
his career.
Throwing picks. He was throwing the ball to the wrong places because he was so terrified of throwing picks. What Russell Wilson does is he puts the ball.
You're not
going to
throw a pick on a 6 yard out like that's or whatever. I mean, whatever play it is, like a button
or,
hook.
Or
like,
Pete
and he
got
was not
in his
as
head.
Sharp on those fucking passes
Pete
in the second half of the season.
In his
again,
head.
Why do you
Pete Carroll ruined
do this?
Russell Wilson. Why do you not see that that's the fact? He said it today. He's like, hey, world, this is the same shit as your fucking... He said today, hey, halfway through this year, I tried to break Russell Wilson. And then what? Guess what? Russell Wilson broke. He did it. He said the thing. I'm so upset on behalf of Russell Wilson.
Pete Carroll did not just immediately in week 9. That was the first time he ever was concerned about turnovers.
He lost.
He's been concerned about turnovers the entire fucking time. And Russell Wilson was very good in the context of that offense for a long period of time. So it isn't just that.
Maybe you're Russell Wilson.
I reject that hypothesis.
And maybe you're Russell Wilson. You're playing the best season of your career as a human being. You're playing the best season of your career by far. And all of a sudden you're 85-year-old coach comes in and is just like, hey, what you're doing as the best season
you don't
career,
need to exaggerate
good.
Everything you Sorry, can just okay. make an you're honest saying- argument and the argument will stand on its face okay. because the facts are bad enough themselves
okay. Pete Carroll is your 69-year-old coach comes in and is like, hey, the best season of your career is not good enough, right? You have to do better. You have to do all this plus you can't turn the ball over. And we're going to actually make sure that the plays that you ran that actually meant that you were a successful quarterback, we're not running those anymore. Those are out of the playbook, right?
I mean, to some extent, they were not able to run those plays. They still tried to take deep shots in the second half of the season.
No,
they weren't
there
in the same way.
There is a difference between taking deep shots within the context of a good offense and taking deep shots at random times, right? Like, it looks anemic. You can't tell me that it didn't.
Jeez, I was told on this very podcast yesterday that the single most important thing for an offense was to be unpredictable. And yet today, when you take deep shots at random times,
but
that's
not,
a fault.
But it's not that they were unpredictable. It's that nothing was working. When you're like 3rd and 10 or whatever, they had no offense in the second half of the year. I would be pissed if I was Brian Schottenheimer. Look, we've given him a lot of blame, and Pete Carroll was like, hey, this isn't on Shoddy, this isn't on Russ, this is on me, and he took credit for it.
So other things that Pete Carroll highlighted.
Do you disagree with me on this point? He took credit for the offense being bad, and he gloated about the W's that they took over Dwayne Haskins, over Carson Wentz, and a loss to fucking Colt McCoy over Sam Darnold. He was just like, look at the record over the second half of the year when we played the worst fucking teams in the league. That's what he said.
This was the press conference.
Am I not stating facts enough for you? Are these actually not the worst teams in the league?
No, the issue is that you continually repeat yourself when you've already made the argument. This was the press conference and radio show interview where Pete Carroll officially lost me. Like, last year we had the whole debate where Ben put forward the argument that the Seahawks should fire Pete Carroll. And I was still at that point from the standpoint of it's a huge risk. The Seahawks have been very successful. Pete Carroll is an exceptional motivator and leader in many ways. And the risk of going from that to Mike Hopkins is too great to have. But now when you've got him not learning anything from this season and you've got a period of time where the Seahawks are all in on winning now, given all the draft picks they've traded away, their cap issues, all of that, they have to do everything possible to win now. And Pete Carroll clearly is not capable of that. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, he signed a 5-year extension through 2025 during the season. So this is all academic, but it's still important to say, I think.
I think a couple of things can be true, which is we can like Pete Carroll as a person. We can love Pete Carroll as a person, right?
He's the greatest coach in Seahawks franchise history, bar none.
I guess I'm gonna give three thoughts here. Number one, Pete Carroll is a great human being. As an individual, Pete Carroll is a person who cares about his players more than anything. Pete Carroll is so supportive of human rights issues, civil rights issues. Pete Carroll is there marching right across I-90 from Newcastle, not Renton, across that bridge. And he is there with his
team. He can't help where they built I-90.
It's actually probably Bellevue. But he is there with his team, right? Like, Pete Carroll is such a motivator of human beings. Everybody wants to play for Pete Carroll. And I think that Pete Carroll is such an inspirational coach. And going through the season without having a single COVID case is, again, we talked about this before, like one of the most impressive feats of Pete Carroll's entire career.
And that was also confirmed on Monday that Jonathan Bullard's COVID-19 test that landed him on the list was a false positive. So they did, in fact, go through the season with no positive tests.
Pete Carroll is a great human being and an extraordinarily impressive human being. Right? And we will always look at him as the best coach in Seahawks history. And also, Pete Carroll is not the right coach for this team right now. And somewhere deep down, there is an understanding of how to win football games for Pete Carroll. He understands this because he does it with his defense, but he is incapable of processing that with an offense. And you know who else we love? Equally so, or maybe even more so than Pete Carroll? And that's Russell Wilson. And Russell Wilson's career being attached to Pete Carroll for the better part of it so far. I mean, all of it so far, but probably the better part of it ever means that Russell Wilson will have never been able to have been actualized as a quarterback. One of the most impressive quarterbacks we have ever seen in our entire lives, right? Easily the greatest Seattle Seahawks quarterback of all time. My favorite athlete, maybe of all time. You know, he's in the conversation with Kemp and Peyton and Griffey. That's it, right? Kemp, Peyton, Griffey, Russ.
Sue Bird.
But I don't feel strongly, right? Like, I don't feel strongly about Sue Bird. Watching Sue Bird play doesn't mean as much to me as it does as some of those other players. And I'm just being honest. But seeing Russell Wilson not be able to be Russell Wilson is a really frustrating thing. Because the thing is, when you're a coach, there's only so much that you matter. And the players on the field matter a hell of a lot more than the coaching staff does. And that is such a frustrating piece. And understanding that Russell Wilson has gone his entire career with somebody as a coach who doesn't want to put him in the best position as a quarterback is such a difficult place to be, right? Because I want to see Russell Wilson be the quarterback that he can be. And we saw that for a period of time. And then midway through the season, there was a coach who said to themselves, I don't want Russell Wilson to be as good as he can be. And I think that is a very difficult position to be in, both as Russell Wilson and as a fan of this team. Because, look, we want to see winning football more than anything. And I don't think that caring more about turnovers than wins than beating the Washington football team by whatever, 3 points, being scared about Dwayne Haskins coming down on drive, losing the Giants at home, is the best position that Russell Wilson can be in. And I would love to see Russell Wilson in an offense run by somebody who is not Pete Carroll.
I mean, this sort of relates to a question that we got from...
Wait, I want to finish this point. I was making 3 points. Hold on. I went on a fucking roll here. But I don't know if it's Brian Schottenheimer who's wrong, necessarily. And I think that the offense looked very different in the second half of the season than it did in the first half of the season. And I think that we had a coach who came out and said that he changed the offense. So I don't think we can necessarily blame Brian Schottenheimer. But I want to see Russell Wilson in a different scheme, in a scheme that emphasizes the quarterback rather than bringing the quarterback back, holding the quarterback back. The third point that I want to say is, we've had this conversation a lot this year. How many good coaches and coordinators do you think there are throughout football? And I think that answer is very few. And I think we saw that this weekend across the NFL. And that's the part that makes me nervous, which is, look, we can say that the Packers have been much better with Matt LaFleur, that the Titans have been much better with Arthur Smith as the offensive coordinator. He's going to be a head coach. We've seen it with, you know, like, what Shanahan has done with the 49ers, what Sean McVay has done with Jared Goff. There aren't that many of those coaches. There are more bad coaches than there are good coaches, and those coaches continue to good jobs across the NFL. If Pete Carroll is not the head coach of the Seahawks, it's not guaranteed that a better coach is going to be the coach of the Seahawks. And that's the only part. Look, I'm done with Pete Carroll. If he was fired tomorrow or whatever, if he retired tomorrow, I'd be like, you know what? Love you, Pete. Excited to see Russ in a different system. But I just don't think we can guarantee that the next system is going to be better than this system. We saw the punt that the Steelers had yesterday. I think finding a coach who can really meet the analytic view of football is so rare. There's once in a blue moon, there's a coach that is meeting that. And that's the piece that if Pete were to leave, it would make me nervous, because the next coach could be, who knows, right? It's not necessarily going to be Brian Daboll. It's not necessarily going to be Eric Bieniemy.
It could be Jim Elmora.
It could be Jim Elmora, right? And that's the thing. The entire sport of football has worms in their brains. Like that's the problem. Is this is an issue with the sport of football in general? And look, sports in general, right? Like, not everybody's going to do things the way that the internet sees that they should do things, or that stats say that they should do things. And I think that ultimately, I personally feel the same way that you do. I'm done with Pete Carroll, especially after hearing this press conference. I don't think we can immediately say that the next best option, or that the next option would be better than Pete Carroll, because I think there are so few things out there that are better than Pete Carroll.
I mean, I think one of the things the Brandon Staley quote indicates is that, although I don't love the ageism in terms of coaches, where we just kind of assume that whoever's hot and young is automatically going to be good because of the fact that Sean McVay went to a Super Bowl and Kyle Shanahan went to a Super Bowl, the younger coaches are less likely to be tied to old tropes than older coaches are. And there's value in that.
But how old is Andy Reid, right? Like,
it's more about a willingness to rethink things than it is your age specifically. And for Andy Reid to have a spread game coordinator when, you know, Brad Childress held that role for them
he was seven years younger than Pete Carroll.
His job was to go out and like find out what teams were doing with spread in college football and apply it to the Chiefs, which is a wild concept. And so I've never seen Pete Carroll do it. I've mentioned the read option thing, that they put that in midseason with Daryl Bevel. Like, that was an exciting thing. But at this point, Pete Carroll does not appear interested or able to do that. And that's why, I mean, it should be time for a change, even though obviously it isn't. But this sort of ties into, I thought, an interesting question from Zachary at Z Vazda on Twitter, asking us, you know, talking about, like, people talking about trading Russell Wilson, which is not going to happen. Trading Russell Wilson for a high draft pick, which, if like that's such a genius move to get a high draft pick and build around them, then why would the other team do it? Because you know, the other teams are trying to win too. But his comment was like, yes, I want the Seahawks to be win another Super Bowl. Yes, I'd be still be happy if they did it without Russ, but I'm just as invested in Russ being great in the world, seeing him be great, which I'm like, that actually might require a trade. He's our franchise QB, and I honestly don't want him to play for anyone else. I would love for him to play his entire career with us and would sacrifice some amount of Super Bowl percentage to do that. Would be interested in your thoughts. How much would Super Bowl percentages have to increase for you to want a QB other than Russ? And I feel like that's, it's too early to answer that question, because that's the question you answer when he gets to like the, you know, the late, the Carmelo Anthony stage of his career.
Oh,
like, we're not there yet.
I don't think it's the Carmelo. We saw it last night, right? We saw Ben Roethlisberger sat on the sideline, right? Like that's what this ends at, I suppose. But
we're so far from where at right now.
We've got a decade. Look, Russell Wilson is not that young. Russell Wilson has been in the quarterback of the Seahawks for a long time, even though it's somehow still the year 2000. Russell Wilson has been the quarterback of the Seahawks. This next year will be a decade, and he didn't come into the league as a young quarterback. And I don't know. Like, what's the question of... I can't conceive a scenario that the Seahawks are a Super Bowl contender without Russell Wilson, right? Like, if they could trade Russell Wilson for Deshaun Watson, sure. I don't know. Maybe sign me up, right? Like, if they could immediately trade Russell Wilson for Trevor Lawrence, like, that probably would be a worthwhile trade, I suppose. But it doesn't matter. Like, we love Russell Wilson, right? He is, I mean, I said earlier, he's the athlete that I care the most about, basically.
All right, if you want to take a more optimistic spin on Pete
Carroll's I want Russell Wilson to be put into the best situation to win. And I think the winning has been a negative for this team. Like, they haven't been a bad team, right? Like, they were not a bad team this year. That's the part that I think people are forgetting, is this team that the Seahawks put together, they were probably overrated by DVOA, but they won 12 games. And winning with bad process is a negative, all told. That's how you end up with coaches who shouldn't be there, with players who shouldn't be there. I would rather good process and losing than bad process and winning. If that means that you're going to get ousted in the first round of the playoffs, in the second round of the playoffs, good process leads to Super Bowls. And that's what we saw for, you know, nobody's going to recreate what Belichick did with the Patriots. But like, Bill Belichick's tenure with the Patriots was an exercise in good process. And that's how you keep it up for so long. You have a quarterback and you have good process. And that's how you keep a dynasty up for 2+ decades. That's how you make sure that a quarterback who... in a lot of ways, is probably not better than Russell Wilson, right? He was
Let's remain calm here.
I'm just saying, Tom Brady was constantly put in the best position.
Sure, you know, he also went to a... I mean, Tampa Bay was set up to succeed in many ways, but he also went to a team that was not a playoff team last year.
Tom Brady's career has been better than Russell Wilson's, but like, raw as a quarterback, is he necessarily that much better than Russell Wilson?
I mean... Tom Brady is arguably the greatest quarterback of all time. Let's remain calm here.
What I'm saying is that Tom Brady is, yes, the greatest quarterback of all time, but to be the greatest quarterback of all time, you need to be put in a good position. And to be put in a good position means being put into the best process. And that's what Bill Belichick did. For 2 decades, he had the best process of basically any coach/front office. And that's what they did with him. And that's where Russell Wilson has not been. He has not been put in a good process. He's won with bad process. And that is a bad place to be for a quarterback.
And it's not ever going to change. So other things that Pete Carroll highlighted that maybe can lead to a more positive spin on the media availability today. Obviously, the third downs, which we talked about, are something that, you know, the Seahawks are likely to regress to the mean, and it's likely to benefit them. And then he also highlighted something that we have wanted for a long period of time, which is the quick passing game. Here was his quote on Saturday. "We needed to throw the ball quicker in the game to get some efficiency and feel towards it. We mixed it. We missed a couple chances in the quick game. We didn't connect on a couple of the throws that we needed to. Russ was a little bit off, and there were a few drops in the game that were crucial. All of those plays were crucial because the game was so tight. I wish we would have gotten the ball out quicker, more often in the game." And that's where I wonder, like, we talked with Ben about adding a third playmaker at wide receiver, but I wonder if the way to kind of square the circle on what Pete Carroll wants in terms of being able to run the ball against two high defenses and also still be a threat in the quick passing game is to do what Bill Belichick did with the Patriots in their late era and run a lot more two tight end sets, because those you allow you to take advantage of matchups in terms of you've got those blockers out there if you want to run against a light box. But if teams then load up the box and bring that safety, second safety down, then you've got the ability to make plays in the passing game. And that's where they probably got to get better at tight end, because Jacob Hollister this year averaged 5.2 yards per target. Greg Olsen, who seems likely to retire and head into the broadcast booth for Fox, 6.5 yards per target. Will Dissly averaged 8.7 yards per target, but was targeted the least often of the Seahawks' three tight ends, despite playing the most snaps.
Okay. I mean, are they going to invest the resources, like you're saying, that if you're comparing it to the Patriots, they invested real resources in tight end. The Seahawks have Jacob Hollister, who is an undrafted free agent, Greg Olsen, who they paid a lot of money to, but also is an aging tight end, and Dissly, who is a fourth round pick. They have invested.
I mean, Gronk was like a third round pick, wasn't he? He fell because of injuries. I mean, it'll be interesting to see whether they can get anything from Colby Parkinson after a season in the system and hopefully an healthy offseason.
I know this is a hot take. I think that the idea of, well, I'm not going to say that. I'm not as huge on the quick passing game as other people are. I think deep passing is extraordinarily important, and I think intermediate passing is important, but quick passing,
it depends what that
motion,
quick passing
play
is,
action can,
about.
Can make quick passing less important. But that's the thing, is when Pete Carroll talks about, he says the most important thing that a defense like the Rams do is 99, right? It's Aaron Donald. That's who we're going to neutralize. And you know what they did against it? Is they did a bunch of straight dropbacks, right? They did nothing to keep him on his toes, right? It's not just about this quick passing.
I think they ran play action. You're more convinced that they went away from the play action game than I am.
Look at these numbers. Did you see any play action? I mean, I think this was a tweet from maybe Stephen Cohen, who was saying that Pete Carroll talks about the most important thing the Rams do is 99. And also the Seahawks run 28 straight dropbacks with no play action whatsoever, no motion. Like, that's not, it is just not part of the offense. And that's what you do to get those things off their heels more than I think quick passing is. I think that motion, and I think play action is a lot more important than quick passing is to the passing game. That's just me personally. I agree with you that they need better tight ends.
Gronk was a second round pick, as it turns out.
And Aaron Hernandez were both second round picks, right? I don't disagree with that in principle, that they should be better at what they're doing, but like, these are not comparable, right?
Hernandez was the fourth round pick, although.
Oh, okay.
That.
I don't think the Seahawks and the Patriots are comparable, and that's it. You can't say that the greatest fucking football team of all time, if you're going to reject the idea that Russell Wilson and Tom Brady are not necessarily that different of quarterbacks, but then say that they have.
I mean, okay, by comparison, the Rams used a lot more two tight end sets this year, whereas they had historically been almost exclusively an 11 personnel team with three wide receivers.
Well, the Rams offense wasn't necessarily that good this year, but.
Well, they had a terrible quarterback. So
exactly.
Were,
you're comparing Jared Goff and Russell Wilson. These things are not comparable, right?
So, like, if you, but that's the whole point of the Aaron Rodgers situation is like, hey, what if we took the Sean McVay offense and put one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time in it? Oh, it turns out actually, that's a great offense.
Yeah, no shit. They'll be on the fucking first class to the Super Bowl. That's what we want. We want Robert Tonyan to be wide open, but there aren't that many Matt LaFleurs out there.
Well,
I don't know. Obviously, we want a fucking coach like Matt LaFleur. He took a bad Aaron Rodgers team to be 13-3 last year. Is that what they were?
Well, I mean, that was luck. I don't know if that had anything to do with coaching.
Come on. And then this year they got good, right? Like, of course that's what we want, but there aren't that many Matt LaFleurs.
You're definitely not going to find one not trying. That's the
obviously
thing. As far as other news from Pete Carroll's availability, he said he expects the coaching staff to remain intact.
If you could flip Pete Carroll for Steve Sarkisian right now, would you take that trade?
Probably, yeah.
I love it.
Falcons offense. Pete Carroll's Falcons. I'm sorry, Pete Carroll. Steve Sarkisian's. Pete Carroll's Falcons offenses actually were quite good too. I don't know if you remember Matt Schaub's numbers. Sark's Falcons offenses were pretty good in terms of DVOA, as much
I'm
as everyone
you,
hated on because of small sample randomness in the red zone.
10 times out of 10, free Sark. Love Sark.
Carroll said he expects the coaching staff to remain intact, aside from his son Brennan, who's taking the Arizona Wildcats offensive coordinator job. As we mentioned yesterday, Dave Canales has interviewed for the offensive coordinator job at Vanderbilt, and also interviewing Seahawks vice president of football operations Scott Fitterer for the Carolina GM job on Monday, among 15 candidates to interview so far. A decision from the Panthers on that hire expected soon.
He's only got a whatever percent chance.
I think at least one of those people withdrew, so it's a little better than 1 in 15.
I don't know.
I like those odds.
It's just the whole thing is frustrating. I don't know what to say. Like, we've been.
You don't know what to say after you've been talking all
Pete
this
Carroll
period of time?
Is the biggest blessing and a curse of almost any coach ever, right? Like, the Pete Carroll experience is it is one of the most frustrating things we've seen. But I will say, we saw on Sunday two of the worst decisions to punt in the NFL by coaches who otherwise are probably fairly good coaches, right? Like, that's the thing. This is not a Pete Carroll issue. This is a coaching issue. And just highlighting that the best coach could be good. Well, shit. Like, of course, if we had the best coach in the NFL, the team would be
better. Don't understand. You've argued both sides of this issue so thoroughly.
I'm still not sure where you stand. I would be very excited if they had another coach. I don't think the base perspective should be that the next coach is going to be Matt LaFleur. You know, like that to me is, I think it's a cautionary tale. Like you said, it could be Jim Elmore, you know?
But I think the main takeaway here is, like, the Seahawks floor is higher than a lot of these teams because they have Russell Wilson. So that's the difference here.
I agree with that point, but I just don't know if it's a luck issue, you know, like
said the issue was their process was bad. It can't both be that their process is bad and it's a luck issue. Like, that's
no, it's a fundamentally luck issue. It's a luck issue if they get a good coach otherwise, is what I'm saying. That's the thing that's luck is you can't, as an outside force, we can't go in and say, you're going to hire Arthur Smith or whatever. You're going to hire Eric Bieniemy. Like, we can't say
they're going to get rid of Pete Carroll either. This is all academic.
Yeah,
but
it sucks. I'm telling you,
it doesn't
you
mean
that
we have to be wishy-washy
sucks
about the whole thing.
Being fans of a football team, but I think there are worse outcomes out there than Pete Carroll. It's just that right now, in this very moment, Pete Carroll seems worse than the median outcome for next best coach. Of all the people who are likely to get the next head coaching job and X team, Pete Carroll seems worse than the median outcome of those coaches. And I think this is possibly the first time in his tenure that that's been the case.
Yeah, I agree. That's where the change has happened. That's even last year when Ben was making the case, I didn't feel that way. And now, despite the fact that they went 12-4 and won the division, I do feel that way.
It's not going to fucking matter. None of this matters. Football is terrible. Everything is terrible. Have fun in the pandemic. Nobody's getting the vaccine.
So on that note, next week, our search for Seattle's best chicken.
We should have Jan on to talk about the rules of or the rollout of the vaccine. See what she has to say about people being 70 plus. You know what? Pete Carroll's not getting a vaccine, so that's important. That'll be good for Jan. She'll like that she's in the same boat as Pete Carroll. Would that be fun?
If anyone is still left, if the listener is still left, thanks for listening.
Thanks. Oh God. Anyway, you hear what I was saying, that we have to cheer for the Knucks even more in these last years of.
I don't know if I agree with that.
It's like I don't cheer for the Blazers any less, even though there's, and maybe that's because the NBA team hasn't been announced yet. But like,
may not happen.
I feel stronger about the Blazers this year than I almost ever have. Like I'm like more engaged with them on a day to day basis. I feel like.
I mean, you did send out a Christmas card with Baby Fantasy Genius wearing a Blazers T-shirt.
Did I?
You did.
I didn't even think about that. Oh, go Blazers. There we go. Our Portland fans will like that.
Those don't exist.
More of them there than there are in Seattle. I noticed again on Twitter people specifically calling out how good the analysis of fourth place vote getter in the Peltoncast MVP award was, which is
this again
really weird. I didn't actually see anybody calling out the analysis of the famous Cousin Katie. Also, did you know in there it says the fabulous Cousin Katie? So I don't even know if that's the same person.
On the tweet?
Yeah. The fabulous Cousin. No, I don't know such a person.
You have it hanging in the in your basement?
In my office, yes, I do have it up there. Can you see that?
Not it's really.
Like, it's behind Nemo.
Okay. I have it there to remind
myself every time I'm podcasting to be better all the time, pushing me. But you know what? The people who are voting that don't actually listen to the Peltoncast. They just know you. They follow because they're familiar with you from basketball. And they're like, who the fuck is Tristan? And Katie actually lobbies for it. I wouldn't be so shameless. But again, I'm just saying, nobody said, you know, Ben Baldwin had some really good analysis. Kevin Pelton from ESPN, excellent analysis. No. I actually felt like I was really off on that podcast, but in the end, it led to a really strong, coherent point. I feel like I was just like, I went on this like long soliloquy and some of it made sense. But this is the real shit. This is the real talk. Peltoncast year in review. Or Seahawks year in review.
Hello and welcome to episode 244 of the Fabulous Peltoncast, sponsored by our friends Pagliacci
Pizza. If you stumble over the word, the name of the podcast, just start over. Assume that that's the rule. If you can't say your own last name right, you start it over. Pelton. Oh. It's going to be a good one.